content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we will finish an article we started last week titled Sister Queens of the North by Shelley Puhak. Over the centuries, they were forgotten, dismissed, even parodied. But a new book shows that Brunhild and Fridegund boldly seized power and outwitted enemies like few rulers in history. At this point in history, both Brunhild and Fridegund, their husbands have died and they are ruling Francia as regents with their sons. So we'll pick up where we left off in 593 when peace was no longer an option. So peace held until the year after Guntram's death. This is both Brunhild and Fridegund's brother-in-law. Then in 1593, Brunhild approved an attack on Soissons. Fredegund had been ruling from Paris, which meant that the old Neustrian capital had lost some of its importance. But Soissons still retained much of its wealth, and it was right along Brunhild's border. Brunhild wanted it back. She sent Duke Wintrio of Champagne, along with some of the nobles from both Austrasia and Burgundy, to invade the villages and towns surrounding Soissons. The countryside was devastated by their attacks, and all the crops were burned to the ground. Fredegund, meanwhile, ordered her stalwart supporter, Landeric, to marshal what forces he could, and she decided to march out with the men. Typically, men bonded while serving in the armed forces. Armies had their own cultures, jokes, and shared histories. Friendships were formed while marching, pitching camp, deciding strategy. Fortunes were made while robbing and pillaging towns. A queen might occasionally be behind enemy lines with her king while being evacuated from one place to another, but she was decidedly not considered a warrior in her own right. Fredegund, whether by design or out of desperation, wanted to change the script. She and Landeric, and the troops they had been able to gather, marched to Bernay-Riviere, once Chilperic's favorite villa, raided one of the treasuries situated just outside Soissons. There, Fredegund raided one of the treasury storerooms and, like a traditional barbarian king, distributed the valuables among the soldiers. Rather than allowing these riches to fall into the hands of the Austrasians, she had decided to give her men booty in advance of the battle, to ensure their loyalty and steel their nerves once they realized how painfully outnumbered they would be. Fredegund had no hope of beating the opposing forces in outright combat. She decided the battle to defend Soissons should occur at the enemy's camp, 15 miles away in the fields of Choisy. Her only chance was a surprise attack. Fredegund followed the dictums of military handbooks, such as De Re Militari, the same way a male Roman field commander might. She chose the battlefield, and she opted for trickery when confronted by a much larger army. Fredegund ordered her army to march at night, not a typical maneuver. She also counseled her men to disguise themselves. A row of warriors led the march, each carrying a tree branch to camouflage the horsemen behind him. Fredegund had added the inspiration of fastening bells to their horses. Bells were used on horses that were led out to graze. The enemy might hear the ringing and assume it was coming from their own grazing mounts. The earliest surviving record of the Battle of Choisy is from the 8th century chronicle, Liber Historiae Francorum, the history book of the Franks. But the usually terse anonymous author became so incredibly specific in this one instance that he seemed to be drawing upon details immortalized by an account from a local monastery or an oral history. In this telling, a sentry heard the approach of tinkling bells and asked, Weren't there fields in those places over there yesterday? Why do we see woods? Another sentry laughed off this alarm. Because of course you have been drunk. That is how you blotted it out. Do you not hear the bells of our horses grazing next to that forest? So Brunhild's forces slept. At daybreak, they found themselves surrounded and then slaughtered. Fredegund's army saved Soissons and then went on the offensive, riding east and penetrating nearly 40 miles into Austrasian territory, making it all the way to Reims. In retribution for the damage done to the outskirts of Soissons, the chronicle tells us she set fire to Champagne and devastated it. Her armies plundered the villages of the area, and when Fredegund returned home, she did so like a true Frankish warrior, with much booty and many spoils. After the queens died, Fredegund's son, King Clothar II, took steps to obliterate the memory and legacy of his aunt and even of his own mother. Things only got worse for Brunhild and Fredegund's reputations after the Carolingian dynasty took over in the 8th century. There were Carolingian women who attempted to rule as regents too. So historians of the time were tasked with showing that giving women power would lead only to chaos, war, and death. Fredegund was recast as a femme fatale, and Brunhild as a murderess lacking all maternal instinct. With their accomplishments, cut from official histories, the queens took root in legends and myths. A walking forest strategy like Fredegund's appeared more than 1,000 years later in Shakespeare's Macbeth. Some scholars and folklorists have found iterations of this strategy in the 11th century, used by the opponents of the Bishop of Trier, and again at the end of the 12th century, employed by a Danish king to defeat his adversaries. But the Fredegund story predates the earliest of these battles by over 3 centuries. There are mentions of a walking forest and Celtic myths, which are difficult to date. These myths may have been inspired by Fredegund, or perhaps she was raised in a Celtic community before her enslavement and picked up the strategy from an older pagan tale told to her as a child. In 1405, the French poet Christine de Pizan's Book of the City of Ladies resuscitated the story of Fredegund's military leadership to defend the female sex. The valiant queen kept out in front, exhorting the others on to battle with promises and cajoling words. The poet wrote that Fredegund was unnaturally cruel for a woman, but she ruled over the kingdom of France most wisely. During the same period, roads all over France bore the name of Queen Brunhild, or as she was called in French, Brunhaut. The historian Jean d'Autremuse wrote about one such road in 1398. The common people, puzzled by how straight it was, concocted a story that Queen Brunhild had been a witch who had magically paved the road in a single night with the help of the devil. These chaussées de Brunhaut, or Brunhild highways, were mostly old Roman roads that appear to have been renamed to honor the Frankish queen. It's possible to ride a bike or take a Sunday drive down a Chaussée Brunhaut even today. The queens resurfaced in the 19th century as Romanticism swept Europe. In England, there was an obsession with King Arthur, and in France and Germany, with the barbarian tribes that ruled after the fall of Rome. In 1819, people wandered the halls of the Paris Exposition with long hair brushing their shoulders dressed as Merovingians. A flurry of works featured the queens, including a multitude of books, poems, operas, plays, prints, and portraits. The epic poem Nibelungenlied, or the Song of the Nibelungs, written around the year 1200, had been rediscovered and elevated as a national treasure. One of its main plot lines focused on an argument between 2 royal sisters-in-laws that ripped the realm apart. It was this medieval text that served as the inspiration for Der Ring des Nibelungen. Who am I, if not your will? Brunhilde asks her divine father in Wagner's opera. The question still applies today. Who is this queen? A strange parody of herself, singing songs written by and for men, her ambitions, and her humanity hidden underneath a fantastical horned hat. Today, Brunhilde's grave has no marker. The abbey where she was buried, now in East Central France, was sacked during the French Revolution. Only the lid of her supposed sarcophagus remains. Two pieces of the smooth black marble slab are on display in a small museum alongside vases and statue fragments from antiquity. Fredegonde's tomb is on display at the majestic Basilica of Saint-Denis in Paris, where it was relocated after the Revolution. The queen's likeness is rendered in stones and enamel set into mortar. In that image, outlined by copper, the former slave holds a scepter and wears a crown. Yet, for all the glory of the setting, Fredegund's complicated legacy is reduced to the inscription, Fredegundia Regina, uxor Chilpersi Regis, Queen Fredegund, wife of King Chilperic. Neither monarch is commemorated with the title both demanded during their lifetimes, nor wife or not wife or mother of kings, but Presentalismi et Gloriismi Francorum Reginae, the most excellent and glorious queen of the Franks. As a girl, I gobbled up biographies of female historical figures, activists, writers, and artists, but few political leaders, and even fewer from so deep in the past. I don't know what it would have meant for me and other little girls to have found Queen Fredegund and Queen Brunhilde in the books we read, to discover that even in the darkest and most tumultuous of times, women can and did lead. Next, we'll move on to an article titled A Healing Presence by Carol Mithers. Quanay Stewart, a veterinarian who helps animals kept by homeless people, discovers a little-known world of generosity and love. The man standing outside the tent on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles clearly doesn't live in the neighborhood. Tall and fit, he's dressed in jeans and a doctor's blue scrub shirt and carries a medical bag. The tent, one of the many rough structures on the stained sidewalk, sits amid heaped wood pallets, old furniture, and trash. But the man's eyes are fixed on a dog lounging nearby. "Hi, how are you?" he says when the tent flap opens. "I'm a veterinarian, Dr. Quanay Stewart, and I offer free pet care to people experiencing homelessness." He gestures at the dog. "Can I examine your pet?" First comes confused silence. "You're who?" Then suspicion. "Is this animal control here to take my dog?" Finally, a slow nod. Stewart, who calls himself the street vet, kneels, pulls out his stethoscope, and goes to work. These Skid Row streets hold the nation's largest concentration of homeless people who are not staying in a shelter, and at first glance, it's an unrelieved landscape of despair. Mental illness, poverty, addiction. But love exists too, including the love of pets. Across the nation, 10 to 25% of the people who are homeless keep pets. And there's no reason to think the number is lower in sunny Los Angeles. Cats sit on sleeping bags, pit bulls, scruffy terriers, and mutts trot alongside filled shopping carts, and chihuahuas ride in bicycle baskets in the laps of people who have themselves are in wheelchairs. Various local groups and volunteers help the owners of these animals care for them, with weekly and monthly clinics, mobile spay and neuter vans, handouts of flea meds and food. Stewart, 50, has usually worked solo, walking the streets and looking for animals and people in need. "Maybe it's because when I began this work, it wasn't uncommon to find a pet that had never received care," he says. "Everyone I met looked at me as if I'd just dropped out of the sky." Stewart grew up with dogs, loved them and science, and by the time he was 10, he knew that he would become a veterinarian. It was an unusual ambition for a black track star in Albuquerque. Once, a coach asked him about his future plans and laughed with disbelief when Quanay told him. "I never met a black vet," the coach said. Stewart goes on, "At the time, I didn't think much about it, but here's the thing. He was black himself." Decades later, the number of African-American veterinarians is still so small that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has reported that it might as well be zero. Stewart graduated from the University of New Mexico, got his doctorate of veterinary medicine degree from Colorado State University of Veterinary Medicine and Biomedical Sciences, and headed to San Diego. He spent a decade there treating a suburban clientele with bottomless bank accounts. Then, in 2008, he relocated to Modesto in California's Central Valley for a job as the veterinarian for Stanislaus County, and everything changed. The Great Recession flattened Modesto, a city of around 200,000 with plummeting home prices and a 17% unemployment. And when humans go broke, animals often pay the price. Pet surrenders surged until the area's aging shelter, built for 200 animals, held twice as many, and its euthanasia rate became one of the nation's highest. "I was destroying 30 to 50 animals every morning," Stewart says softly. "Healthy dogs and cats. It was killing my soul. I felt like God was keeping score and I was losing. I didn't go to school all those years to destroy animals. I wanted to help and save them." At first, that meant he helped a homeless man he encountered almost daily by treating the man's dog, which suffered from a bad flea bite allergy. Then he held a free clinic at the local soup kitchen. And then, on his own time, he began to walk around Modesto and some Bay Area sites looking for pets to help. He moved to Los Angeles to serve as chief veterinarian officer for the American Humane Society Association, which makes sure animals are treated well on film sets, and his ramblings shifted to San Diego and Los Angeles. He wore scrubs to identify himself, carried a bag filled with meds, vaccines, and syringes, nail trimmers, and he did what he could free of charge. He was stunned by what he found. Like many people, he questioned why homeless people had animals to begin with. If humans couldn't take care of themselves, how could they be responsible for pets? And yet they were. In fact, numerous academic studies over the years have revealed the vital role pets play in the lives of unhoused men and women, providing structure, purpose, meaning, and love. Researchers have consistently found very high levels of attachments to pets among the homeless. Leslie Irvine, a sociologist, writes in her 2012 book about the phenomenon, "My Dog Always Eats First." Stewart agrees. "Pets were a lifeline to the people I met," he says. "Most of them were great pet owners. They did remarkably well with the resources they had and made sacrifices for them well beyond what you or I would. The bond between them was on a completely different level. They needed each other." For 5 years, his efforts were kind of a secret hobby, and he says even his family, he has three children, didn't know about. Then in 2017, he and his brother produced The Street Vet as a reality TV series. It is aired on broadcast TV in Scandinavia and Eastern Europe and in the States on a Utah cable channel. And Stewart acknowledges he's now a media personality. These days, he's founding a new veterinary practice in San Diego and writing a book about his experiences on the street. Last September, he started a nonprofit, Project Street Vet, raising money on GoFundMe to cover the cost of treating pet medical problems beyond the scope of a sidewalk exam. He has occasionally volunteered with larger organizations assisting people who are homeless. Though he says there are probably more efficient ways I could spend my time, he likes doing it that way. "The wound is healing well," he reassures a man named Ben, whose pet rat had been attacked by a cat. "I've seen birds and snakes, but this was my first rat." "The puppy looks great," he tells Julian, a tattooed man who lived on the same stretch of pavement for 2 years and whose dog recently gave birth. He also vaccinates the pups. Stewart marvels at the generosity of a young man named Reggie, who lives in a school bus and uses his own cash to make lemonade that he gives away to his neighbors. Stewart vaccinates the man's dog, Daisy. "You're doing a good job," Stewart says. "Oh, this is such a blessing," the young man replies. Next, we'll move on to an American icon, Crunch Time by Brandon Tinsley. A fussy magnate, a myth chef, and the curious roots of the comfort food we hate to love. When COVID-19 forced people to stay home, many of us found solace in a snack, potato chips. The crispy treats enjoyed around a $350 million increase in sales from 2019 to 2020. When the chips are down, it seems Americans gobble them up. Any search for the origins of this signature finger food must lead to George Crumb, born George Speck. a 19th century chef of Native and African-American descent who made his name at Moon's Lake House in the resort town of Saratoga Springs, New York. As the story goes, one day in 1853, the railroad and shipping magnate Cornelius Vanderbilt was eating at Moon's when he ordered his fried potatoes be returned to the kitchen because they were too thick. Furious with such a fussy eater, Crumb sliced some potatoes as slenderly as he could, fried them to a crisp, and sent them out to Vanderbilt as a prank. Rather than take the gesture as an insult, Vanderbilt was overjoyed. Other patrons began asking for Crumb's Saratoga chips, which soon became a hit far beyond upstate New York. In 1860, Crumb opened his own restaurant near Saratoga known as Crumb's House or Crumb's Place, where a basket of potato chips sat invitingly on every table. Crumb oversaw the restaurant until retiring over 30 years later. In 1889, a New York Herald writer called him the best cook in America. Crumb died in 1914, but today's astounding variety of potato chips, from cinnamon and sugar Pringles to flaming hot dill pickle Lays, are a tribute to the man American Heritage magazine calls the Edison of Greece. Still, historians who have peeled the skin off this story have hastened to point out that Crumb was not the sole inventor of the chip, or even the first. The earliest known recipe for chips dates to 1817, when an English doctor named William Kitchener published The Cook's Oracle, a cookbook that included a recipe for potatoes fried in slicings or shavings. And in July 1849, 4 years before Crumb supposedly dissed Vanderbilt, New York Herald reporter noted the work of Eliza, also, curiously, a cook in Saratoga Springs, whose potato-frying reputation had become one of the prominent matters of remark at Saratoga. Yet scholars are united in acknowledging that Crumb popularized the chip. It was in Saratoga that the chips came into their own. Today you can buy a version of Crumb's creations under the name Saratoga Chips. And in America, that they became a culinary and commercial juggernaut. For a long time, chips remained a restaurant-only delicacy. But in 1895, an Ohio entrepreneur named William Tappenden found a way to keep them stocked on grocery shelves. Using his kitchen and later a barn-turned-factory in his backyard to make the chips and deliver them in barrels to local markets via horse-drawn wagon, countless other merchants followed suit. It would take another bold innovator to ignite the revolution, the result of which no birthday party or football game or trip to the office vending machine would ever be the same. In 1926, Laura Scudder, a California businesswoman, began packaging chips in wax paper bags that included not only a freshness date, but also a tempting boast, the noisiest chips in the world. A peculiarly American marketing breakthrough that made a virtue of being obnoxious. The snack took another leap the following year when Leonard Yap, or Jap, a Chicago chef and former prize fighter, began to mass produce the snack, largely, the rumor goes, to serve one client, Al Capone, who allegedly discovered a love for potato chips on a visit to Saratoga and thought they would sell well in his speakeasies. Jap opened factories to supply the snack to a growing list of patrons, and by the 1930s was selling to clients throughout the Midwest. As potato chips continued their climb into the pantheon of American treats. Later, Jap also created what would be considered the modern iteration of frying his potatoes in oil instead of lard. When Lay's became the first national brand of potato chips in 1967, the company enlisted Burt Lahr, famous for playing the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz, as its first celebrity spokesman, who purred the devilish challenge, "Bet you can't just eat just one." Americans today consume about 1.85 billion pounds of potato chips annually, or around 6.6 pounds per person. The U.S. potato chip market, just potato chips, never mind tortilla chips or cheese puffs or pretzels, is estimated at $10.5 billion. And while chips and other starchy indulgences have long been criticized for playing a role in health conditions such as obesity and hypertension, the snack industry has cleaned up its act to some extent, cooking up options with less fat and sodium, from sweet potato chips with sea salt to taro chips to red lentil chips with tomato and basil. Still, for many Americans, the pint of chips has always been pure indulgence. Following a year of fast food buzz, last October, Hershey released the most sophisticated snack mashup since the yogurt-covered pretzel, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups stuffed with potato chips. Only history can judge whether this triple-flavored calorie bomb will be successful. But more than a century and a half after Crumb's peevish inspiration, the potato chip isn't just one of our most popular foods, but also our most versatile. Inventing How We Eat by Chris Klimek. Other Black innovators who helped Americans work magic in the kitchen and beyond. Alfred Krall, the ice cream scoop. Working at a Pittsburgh hotel, Krall saw that serving ice cream with spoons was a sticky task. In 1897, he patented a tool with a mouthful of a name, the ice cream mold and disher. Norbert Rieu, refining sugar. Granulating sugarcane on an industrial scale was difficult and dangerous. Then Rieu, born in New Orleans, educated in Paris, patented a new method in 1846 that was much more efficient and saved laborers from being burned by boiling juice. Still used to make sugar and glue, Rieu's system helped the U.S. dominate the 19th century sugar trade. Joseph Lee's bread-making machine. Building on his 1894 invention of a commercial bread kneading machine, which helped prevent wasted flour at his Woodland Park Hotel, the Boston-area inventor patented this contraption in 1902. Could mix ingredients and knead dough automatically, a direct precursor to today's bread makers. And finally, Frederick McKinley Jones, refrigeration unit. His mobile fridge designed for trucks and trains, 1942, made the supermarket possible. It also saved lives during World War II, powering air conditioners for Allied field hospitals to keep blood packs and other supplies from expiring. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.